The ability to get together and work harmoniously on issues can make a tremendous difference.
Collaborating on the future of the Tongass National Forest. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, August 22nd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Petersburg cleans up damage from a landslide in town.
The slide area is not immediately adjacent to the Public Works building, but it is pretty close and pretty unnerving, to say the least.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
AT&T, rethink possible. Details at att.com/Alaska or 1-800-252-7266. And by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for over 30 years.
At least one-fifth of the Alaska legislature attended a conference in Hawaii this month at a cost of nearly $35,000 so far. The Anchorage Daily News reports the final cost is still being tallied from the Council of State Governments West Conference. CSG West is a nonpartisan policy group comprised of lawmakers from Western states. This year's event was at the Sheraton Waikiki Hotel. Hotel bills for each of the lawmakers have ranged from $729 to $1,276. But that doesn't include Senator Bert Stedman, a Republican from Sitka, who was in a suite with a bill averaging more than $900 per night. He attributed that to a mistake by his office. Lawmaker travel this year has also included a trip to Greece for the Special Olympics, a conference in New Orleans, and plans for a Norway policy tour starting this weekend. No one responded to the Senate Finance Committee's request for proposals for an independent audit of the Goose Creek Correctional Center. Committee aide Darwin Peterson said the audit's scope and timeline may have been too aggressive. The solicitation sought a status report by October 30th and a final report to the committee by December 15th. The legislature is scheduled to convene in January. During the last regular session, concerns were raised about the costs of the medium security prison expected to open next year at Point McKenzie. The request for proposals sought answers to a long list of questions, including whether decisions were made with full knowledge of funding limits and whether the site selected was cost-effective. Peterson said other options are being considered, including limiting the scope or doing some work in-house. U.S. Department of Agriculture Undersecretary for Natural Resources and the Environment Harris Sherman is traveling around Southeast Alaska this week. He oversees the U.S. Forest Service. On Saturday, he met with the Juneau Economic Development Council and then traveled to Sitka yesterday to hear from business and community leaders about the future of the Tongass National Forest. Sherman last visited the region about a year ago. Sunday's conversation in Sitka was closed to the general public and the news media. Sherman spoke with reporters afterward.
The ability to get together and work harmoniously on issues can make a tremendous difference. And I think we're seeing here today in Sitka and elsewhere much greater collaboration than we've seen in the past.
Sherman says a lot of that collaboration is taking place between the timber industry and the environmental community. He says both sides have a vested interest in restoring the Tongass National Forest. Among the groups represented on Sunday was the Sitka Conservation Society, which urged Sherman to increase funding to restoration efforts. Their proposal calls for $80 million over 10 years for restoration, $5 million over 5 years for fisheries enhancement, and $2.25 million for education programs aimed at tourists and schools. It also urges more money for research and rural development. Andrew Tomes is executive director of the Conservation Society. He says the Forest Service, especially locally, is heading in the right direction.
I think the Sitka District has really shown the way, and their fisheries and watershed crew are leaders on the Tongass National Forest and some of the projects we have going here. So we're leading the way, and we're hoping for funding that continues that program and bolsters it. Today in the meeting, they heard about how important the permitting and the licensing is for our hydroelectric projects and how we need to shift resources from the timber program to the hydro program so that communities like Sitka, who are applying for projects like Blue Lake, can get those moving.
Blue Lake is one of two sources of hydroelectric power in Sitka. The city is in the middle of a project to raise the dam and install additional equipment that will help generate more power. Sherman is scheduled to be in Ketchikan and Craig for the rest of the week. The city of Petersburg is declaring a local disaster after heavy rains caused a substantial landslide into a downtown stream on Saturday afternoon. There were no injuries or damage to nearby homes, but the slide took out part of the parking lot at the city's public works facility and filled part of the stream with debris. KFSK's Matt Lichtenstein reports.
A police cruiser blocked the entrance to the public works compound over the weekend as city crews dealt with the aftermath of Saturday's slide. It happened late in the afternoon behind the public works shop on a tall, steep slope above Hammer Slough. It started in the parking lot and filled the shallow waterway below with soil and trees. According to city officials, there was no fuel spilled, but workers put a sorbent boom in place downstream as a precaution. A key power pole that carries electricity to most of the town was precariously close to the edge of the slide and left. Electrical workers had to stabilize it. Acting city manager and public works director Carl Hagerman briefed a few city councilors and the mayor at a special meeting on Sunday.
The slide area, the slough, didn't get much worse overnight. After the pole was stabilized, we didn't see much more movement. There was a little bit. It's still concerning. The slide area right now is not immediately adjacent to the public works building, but it is pretty close and pretty unnerving, to say the least, that we're losing some ground up there next to our building.
The public works building is on piling, and Hagerman was hopeful it would stay in place even if more ground sloughed off. The weather cooperated with cleanup crews Sunday with cloudy skies but little rain. While there are homes and warehouses on both sides of the stream, there were no structures in the path of the slide itself. Still, the city said it had notified nearby property owners of the danger of additional slides and has asked the general public to stay away from the site. Hagerman estimated roughly 1,000 yards of material went into the slough, which is a fish stream. He said the city had notified state emergency service officials, the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, and would also be contacting the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. According to Hagerman, the city was declaring a local disaster in the hopes of getting financial assistance from the state. The mayor and councilors ultimately approved spending up to $250,000 on cleanup and repairs for the time being, with the understanding that they may have to increase that number. In Petersburg, I'm Matt Lichtenstein.
The Nome Police Department is investigating a shooting and attempted suicide that took place Sunday afternoon in Nome. KNOM's Ben Matheson has the story.
Police received a report of a man attacking a woman on West 4th Avenue just after noon. A policeman found Brenda Anungatoguk in front of the residence with a gunshot wound and multiple lacerations. The officer saw Al Roby Anungatoguk flee the scene. Backup officers arrived along with state troopers. The early investigation indicates that Al Roby attacked Brenda with an ulu. Police reports say Brenda was able to flee, but Al Roby then shot Brenda with a rifle outside the residence. Brenda suffered one shot to the upper torso. Nome Police Chief John Papasadora says Al Roby returned to the residence, shot himself in the chest, and fled.
Apparently, from what we can understand at this point, Mr. Anungatoguk left the area after abandoning the rifle at a nearby residence and then went to the hospital for treatment of a chest wound, which appears to be self-inflicted.
Brenda and Al Roby were medevaced to Anchorage for additional medical care. The two individuals are related. Papasadora says it's too early to name a motive. The chief could not comment on whether alcohol was a factor. Papasadora says the community played a role in helping the police on Sunday.
I do appreciate the help of the public. There are several people who were witnessing what was going on. They were calling in, actively calling in, giving us intelligence and information. And I do commend the people of Nome for taking an active interest and part in the safety of the community.
Reporting in Nome, I'm Ben Matheson.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, paying attention to the smaller fish in the ocean who feed the big fish.
For so many years, we've looked at our oceans and we wait till there's a collapse of a fishery before we take action.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for over 50 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. Crowley.com.
The Rasmussen Foundation sabbatical program offers nonprofit executives and tribal leaders paid time away from their jobs for personal renewal and growth. As a result, organizations often become stronger. October 1st is the deadline to apply. Learn more at Rasmussen.org. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation.
The Bristol Bay Times is going to disappear for a while, along with the Arctic Sounder and the Dutch Harbor Fisherman. Those papers were sold off August 5th after the Chelista Corporation liquidated their weekly newspaper chain. The new owners had hoped to keep the papers going without any interruption, but they will have to stop publishing during the transition. KDLG's Stacia Eaton has more.
Jason Evans, the new co-owner of three rural Alaska newspapers, says the papers will cease to be published during a transition period that could stretch into next month. Evans and his wife, Kiana Peacock, recently purchased the Bristol Bay Times, the Arctic Sounder, and the Dutch Harbor Fisherman from Alaska Newspapers Incorporated, which is a subsidiary of the regional native corporation, Chelista.
Our initial plan was to try to not miss a publication. It was a little hard getting some of the archives and records and files that we need to keep publication going from Alaska Newspapers. And so there is going to be a delay, and we're about a week from knowing how long that delay is, but we're hoping that we'll be back in publication in early September, but we're not positive of that date just yet.
The last editions of the papers under the direction of Alaska Newspapers Incorporated came out this week. When the papers next hit newsstands, they'll be published by the new owners, who also will be publishing The Equipment Shopper and The Bush Shopper. Evans says he and his wife have been inundated with input from people asking them to find a way to keep the papers coming out.
One of the most conservative thoughts is that we would hold publication off for a couple of months, but we have gotten tremendous feedback from people that they don't want it to stop. We're getting advertising supporters coming to us saying, you know, they'll commit to making sure the paper gets out sooner. So if we have to, you know, we might shrink a little bit of content in the near future, but long term, we want a really good quality product for the people in the region.
Evans says he's been scrambling to get bids from printing companies and working to find a new office space in Anchorage. Evans says he and his wife are also making plans to expand the local footprint of the papers. He says they hope to keep the reporters who work for them in place.
Our goal is to keep the existing people that have been writing for these three papers that we bought, but there's a lot of things that we're not positive about just yet. We had hoped that we would have figured that out at this point in time, but it's taken a little longer, and you know, it's going to take probably another week until we got everything laid out and that we could announce to everybody, you know, when the first new publication will come out and how to reach us and how to get a hold of us and how to get content to us.
Evans is currently the vice president of consulting for the Alaska Growth Company and is a graduate of Alaska Pacific University. His wife is from Kotzebue and works for Alaska Airlines. In recent days, there have been rumors swirling around Dillingham that the new Bristol Bay Times could somehow be slanted in favor of development of the proposed Pebble Mine. Evans says those fears are unfounded.
I don't know enough about that issue to take a strong stand, and that's really where I want the people of the region to provide that editorial comment of what they feel about Pebble and other issues in the region. That it's less important what I think on an issue, and it's more important about what the people of the region feel, and we're going to be happy to carry that content forward for them. We want to create the platform for people to exercise a voice to everyone in the region.
Evans adds that although he works for Alaska Growth Capital, which was hired by the Pebble Partnership to coordinate a business development contest called Bristol Bay Marketplace, buying the newspapers was a personal endeavor, and it's in no way associated with his other work. Evans says he won't be able to give a hard date for the next publication of the weeklies for another week or two, but he hopes all the papers, the Bristol Bay Times, the Arctic Sounder, and the Dutch Harbor Fisherman, will be coming out again sometime in September. One of the most important things to ensure they do come out, Evans says, is lining up advertisers and citizen journalists to write editorials and columns. In Dillingham, I'm Daisha Eaton.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture is giving $200,000 in grant money to an organization that will help farmers in rural Alaska. KDLG's Mike Mason has the story.
Last week, USDA announced that $3 million has been set aside to fund projects intended to support Native American communities. $200,000 of that money is going to the Alaska Manufacturing Extension Partnership. Tom Myers is the deputy director of the partnership. He says the money will be used to help farmers in rural Alaska get their products directly to customers.
The foundation of this program is to basically have these folks get up and on the ground, if you pardon the pun, with an ability to grow product in a northern climate. So we're taking best practices that other farmers have used and created around the state, and we're pulling that together into a training program that helps these new startup farmers, if you want to call them that, get out there with the best technology that has been created for northern latitude farming.
In rural Alaska, most of the fresh vegetables are shipped in from other parts of Alaska, the lower 48 states, or other locations across the globe. That often results in higher prices and a poor quality product that is not as fresh as it could be if it were produced locally. Meyer says as part of the grant funding, the USDA helped pre-select farmers in rural Alaska that will be part of the new program this year.
But we will be opening up to a wider audience after next spring.
Currently, the vast majority of the commercial farming efforts in Alaska is based in the Mat-Su Valley and in other well-established farming areas. Meyer says the grant money should allow for help in developing a farming effort in other good farming areas in rural Alaska.
Most of the folks in this program are from very rural areas. And in fact, there's a number of folks from Dillingham and Bethel because of the potential with the virgin soils out there in the area and the lack of farming that's happening out there in that region.
The Alaska Manufacturing Extension Partnership was established in 2004 and is headquartered in Anchorage. It has a stated mission of establishing a sustainable base of manufacturing in Alaska, which includes farming. Meyer says those looking at starting their own small business in Alaska need to remember what he calls the three M's: money, management, and marketing.
Because of our distance from any other market, of course, shipping things back and forth and marketing them is very difficult. And then we don't have a depth of manufacturing expertise in the state.
Meyer says in the lower 48 states, about 7 out of every 10 new startup small businesses fail within the first 5 years. That figure is about 9 out of 10 in Alaska. Meyer says along with the new program to help local farmers in Alaska, the Alaska Manufacturing Extension Partnership is trying to prepare existing and new small businesses for the time when true broadband internet is available in their area.
If they line up 10 people, we'll send a trainer out to their village and train them up and get those companies loaded up and online, and within an hour, we have helped them build their e-commerce website.
Meyer says to date, the Alaska Manufacturing Extension Partnership has created over 200 e-commerce websites for small businesses in rural Alaska. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by Northern Air Cargo. For over 54 years, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
The University of Alaska Fairbanks West Ridge is taking on a new look as construction of the new Life Sciences Building progresses. The $88 million three-story, 100,000-square-foot facility will house classroom, laboratory, and office space for biology programs. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the project is on track despite less-than-ideal weather.
Approach the University of Alaska Fairbanks campus from the south, and the skyline looks different. The new Life Sciences Building is taking shape, adding to the West Ridge profile dominated by the flagship architecture of the Museum of the North. UAF Life Sciences Project Manager Cameron Wolford says there's been a lot of progress on the building since groundbreaking in early April.
We have completed all the concrete foundation, and as of last week, we completed all the steel erection for the facility. So now we're proceeding into more detailed work on the structure, such as pouring the slabs, installing the exterior metal studs, and pretty soon, within about a month, you'll start to see the building get closed in.
Wolford says the project is so far within budget and on schedule, despite frequent rain that's made work tough for some aspects of construction.
The rain has been a very big challenge to our civil contractor in trying to install the sewer line and some other utilities around the building. We've had to muck around the mud, feels like all summer long.
Wolford says weather may continue to be an issue as key work to close in before winter needs to happen in September and October without a lot of snow and cold.
On the outside of the building, it gets a metal stud, and then there's the insulation board and a what's called frog skin that goes on the outside of the building wrap that's sticky that will protect us through the winter. And so we kind of need warm temperatures to do that, more so the roof, though. You need a temperature for the roof to install about 32 degrees or above. You don't want it to be below freezing when you install your roof.
Wolford says that's a little sketchy given the roof is scheduled to be applied in the second week of October, a month in which the average high temperature is right around freezing and one of Fairbanks' snowiest. Meanwhile, work on a new greenhouse to replace one that was torn down to make room for the Life Sciences building is expected to be done this fall. Life Sciences is scheduled for completion in the fall of 2013. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Every big fish that lands on your plate got that big by eating lots and lots of little fish. That's why some scientists, fishery managers, and advocacy groups are paying more attention to the small prey in the sea. Northwest News Network correspondent Tom Bonsi reports some environmental groups now also want tighter regulation, and that's making fishermen nervous.
Fisheries biologist Jen Zaman learned lots of things in grad school, but how to get a freshly captured seabird to barf in a bucket was not one of them.
Stubborn.
Some squirts of warm water down the gullet and squeezing the tummy does the trick.
Oh, yeah.
Zaman and her team from the NOAA Research Station in Warrenton, Oregon, want to know, what fish are the diving birds at the mouth of the Columbia River eating?
Yeah, it's definitely anchovy. I can see the dark intestine.
The day before, Zaman says the puke samples mostly contained half-digested surf smelt. Other examples of prey fish include sardines, herring, and mackerel.
So things like sardine and anchovy, which are extremely abundant, very important, not just for fishery, but for feeding other creatures in the food web, mammals, birds, larger fish. So it's very nice. So we know these birds are indicators of where these fish species of interest are.
This seabird dining survey is just one example of scientists paying greater attention to the fortunes of smaller fish. A sea change is even more noticeable among policymakers, managers, and some environmental groups. Earlier this year, the Pew Environment Group started a campaign to protect small schooling fish.
We knew it was the next logical step.
Paul Shively manages the campaign out of Portland.
You know, this issue is picking up more and more steam all across the nation. There's more and more attention, more and more science pointing to the fact that we need to make sure that there's enough food in the oceans.
A separate group called Oceana is running a similar Healthy Ocean campaign. Conservationists report what they see as progress in moving fishery managers to base decisions not just on the big money fish, but on the entire ocean food web. Insiders call this ecosystem-based management. But when talk turns to limits on fishing for small schooling fish, then resistance crops up. Ocean advocates want West Coast fishery managers to cap quotas for bait fish at current levels and put a moratorium on any new fisheries. Commercial fisherman Ryan Kapp of Bellingham argues the West Coast sardine, anchovy, and herring fisheries are already quite conservatively managed.
Seeing that how none of these stocks are overfished or even approaching overfishing, I just assume to leave it alone. We've got enough regulations to keep track of as it is.
Environmentalists worry rising global demand for seafood and fish meal will put pressure on Pacific bait fish. At the Pew Environment Group, Paul Shively invokes the precautionary principle.
We don't need to wait till there's a crisis in our oceans to address an issue. And it's just for so many years we've looked at our oceans and we wait till there's a collapse of a fishery before we take action. And we're saying, you know, it doesn't hurt to have a new paradigm where perhaps we take some precautionary measures.
Shively has made that case to federal fishery advisors, including Bob Emmett, a marine biologist with the federal science agency NOAA. Emmett says it's premature to come down with a hard regulatory hand.
So there's still a lot of data needs that we need to, and to really put, if you were actively managing these fishes, that means you have a lot of information. And we don't believe at this time we really have it.
The fortunes of small fish are also surfacing at the state level. The California legislature is considering a law to promote ecosystem-based management in nearshore state waters. I'm Tom Bonsi near Warrenton, Oregon.
In the near future, astronauts could be treated to the delicacy of Alaska wild salmon even as they orbit high above the ocean the fish came from. From member station KMXT, Brianna Gibbs reports.
Alexandra Oliveira and Brian Himmelblum, associate professors at the University of Alaska Fairbanks School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, and a team of researchers have been studying the potential of freeze-dried sockeye salmon as astronaut food using funding from the University of Alaska's Space Grant Program. Himmelblum said freeze-drying food is common because it extends the shelf life of a product while retaining nutritional value. Unlike conventional drying, freeze-drying involves lowering both the pressure and the temperature, so the structure of the product remains intact. While the funding intended for the freeze-dried salmon to be out of this world, Oliveira said it has very worldly potential in the consumer marketplace.
Camping food, or climbing, or even in meals ready to eat for the military program.
She said salmon wasn't chosen for the research solely on its availability in Alaska waters, but by the fact that it is so nutritious.
And it provides very nice quality marine protein, good amount of marine protein, very nice profile for the fats, for the lipids. It provides minerals, some of the essential minerals. Overall, very round, nutritionally packed product and a lightweight product as well.
The research has also attracted the attention of the Department of Defense.
So the Department of Defense has recently contacted us and asked us that we send them a batch of product so they can test for what they call product's shelf life.
Both Oliveira and Himmelblum feel confident that the fish will pass the testing. I'm Brianna Gibbs.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ed Ronco in Sitka, Matt Lichtenstein in Petersburg, Ben Matheson in Nome, Daisha Eaton and Mike Mason in Dillingham, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Tom Bonsi in Oregon, and Brianna Gibbs in Kodiak. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska.
And by
The Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com. Check the status of your application at pfd.alaska.gov. August 31st is the deadline for placing half in a college savings account and to add or change charitable donations. This message sponsored by the state of Alaska.
You can find APRN headlines and more online at alaskapublic.org. Local, national, and international news, upcoming events, and statewide community conversation. AlaskaPublic.org, connecting you to Alaska one story at a time.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.